heading outdoors for food in the midst of a pandemic. Even before the pandemic hit, there was a boom of interest in locally sourced food. And no food is more locally sourced than what can be found in one's own backyard. From greens to mushrooms to berries to bark, much of what grows wild in Maine has been harvested for nourishment and medicine for centuries. And now, with more people trying to cut down on trips to the grocery store and spending more time outdoors, renewed interest in foraging is growing. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will learn about finding your food and preparing it. Our guest, a Maine foraging expert and a chef who cooks with lots of foraged food. Do you forage? Have you been eager to start? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Foraging has become more popular during the pandemic, not only as a way to be more self-sufficient with your food supply, but also to get outside and enjoy the thrill of the search. Today, we're going to learn about what wild foods you can find in Maine and how to prepare them. Joining me, David Sparr. He is an expert in foraging and the author of Edible and Medicinal Mushrooms of New England and Eastern Canada. And Sam Richman is the chef and owner of Sammy's Deluxe in Rockland. He forages and uses foraged food in his restaurant. And as always, we want to hear from you. Are you wondering if there's anything edible growing near you? Have your grandparents taught you about foraging for something special? What questions do you have about foraging safely? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. And again, 1-800-399-3566. David Sparr, I'll start with you. I know that you've taught classes for years. How would you say right now compares in terms of how many people are interested in learning from you and others how to forage?
There's a definite noticeable pattern that started since the pandemic. I'm foraging where I'm getting more calls about doing private lessons. And also, I'm an administrator of a Facebook group called Edible Wild Plants. And after the pandemic started, we were getting people wanting to be in this group at the rate of almost 300 people a day.
Whoa.
Yeah. So we're up to 87, 88,000 members, something like that now. And so definitely reflects some interest. And over the past few weeks, the number of people trying to get into the group has tailed off some. But when people are trying to get in at 300 a day and you're trying to figure out who you're going to keep and who you're not, it's pretty complicated. But a lot of people want to learn, and a lot of people are worried, I think, to some extent, about our food supply. And there is some reason to worry about the food supply, but probably not quite as much as people think. So, and foraging is one of those things where people have just sort of lost the...
You know, David, it must be, I know you, this means so much to you personally and such a believer in maintaining the heritage of being able to forage for food in Maine. It must be, even though the pandemic is a very discouraging thing, also very satisfying to see people waking up to this.
Oh, well, yeah, that's a fact. I mean, I've been talking about foraging issues up at the state house with the, various legislative committees over the years. And I've been talking about how people can save money and eat better and eat healthier by foraging. And the truth is that if we're going to talk about foraging plants, for instance, there's so many more choices than people think there are.
Sure. And I want to get into some, go ahead.
If you live in the country like I do, I can take a salad bowl or a big bowl, and I can go out in my yard, and I can round up a wild salad in a few minutes. with a lot of different things in it, too, as a matter of fact.
So tell me today, mid-June, if you were to go out and round up a salad, what would be in it?
Oh, I tend to pick a lot of the same things all the time, and I eat a lot of flowers, too. So I like to eat, I do pick dandelion greens to some extent, Sedum purpureum, which is known as Orpine or Live Forever, is a succulent that I pick a lot and grow a lot, and it's pretty common around. Mint, various flowers, it just depends, you know. And,
okay.
Nasturtiums are good, but that's really
it's more from your garden. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to bring you into the conversation, Sam. You're a trained chef. When did you start becoming interested in foraged foods and bringing them into the menus you create?
Well, I guess for about 10 years or so through, really longer a summer camp I went to, it was sort of an augment of an outdoor program area of wild edible foods, and always thought that was interesting. But then I was fortunate to meet a few friends who did this stuff professionally and got my hands dirty, working through some restaurants that took this kind of thing seriously. And then just sort of picked it up as a hobby. You know, it's fortunate that I can take it's a pastime to go out into the woods and bring a basket and grab whatever happens to be around or target something in particular and have an outlet for it at the restaurant.
Do you have foods on your menu that are foraged that are favorites with the customers?
We usually do something or a few things with beach roses every year, usually in pastries, just because they have such a unique flavor and kind of keep it simple just so that the aroma of the beach rose can show off. In the fish seafood world, a lot of mackerel dishes, alewives and squid, and then all kinds of vegetables, some ramps here and there, but they're, not super. There's not a ton of ramps in Maine, but so use them sparsely. Pickles and fermenting them makes their flavor stretch a lot further. We like using dandelion greens and other herbs, garlic, mustard, and then, lots of mushrooms when they're available.
All right. And I'm going to turn back to you for that, David. When are mushrooms available? When do people who are really expert like you, when's the first time in the spring you go out, and how late into the fall or even in the winter do you go out?
Well, in the spring and the early summer, there really aren't too many mushrooms around. People look for morels, but they're hard to find. So they're not like, if you're a forager who's selling food like I do, it's usually not worth the time to go out and see if you can find any morels. And most of the time, if I do find them, I eat them myself. But chicken of the woods, so-called, or I actually like calling it sulfur shelf better. You can find those in June, and they can be fairly large. And if you, over a period of years, start developing locations where mushrooms like that grow, you might be able to find some. But the season doesn't really get started until right around now. Chanterelle season will start, and for people looking for chanterelles at this time of year, your time is best spent looking in pines, balsam firs, and various spruce trees. Then later on in the season, it will move over to where they will be growing with certain hardwoods as well. And that speaks to the fact that chanterelles in Maine really aren't one species. It's really three or four cryptic species that the average person can't discriminate morphologically, but it doesn't really matter.
What would you say to people who are afraid of poisonous mushrooms and afraid to get started?
Well, first of all, there is definitely a level of understanding there that you need. When in doubt, you throw it out.
Right.
But you, certain mushrooms are pretty easy. And if you start off by knowing what amanitas are, the various species of in the Amanita genus, once you figure it out structurally what they look like, if you're a beginning mushroomer, you simply avoid all Amanita, period. Okay, and then also little brown mushrooms. Don't look at them, don't pick them, don't think about what they are. Just simply avoid them. And by avoiding Amanitas and little brown mushrooms, we can cut down our chances of death by mushroom by about 95%, I would say. So little brown mushrooms and Amanitas should be off the list right away.
All right. I want to ask you, Sam, you've cooked in, you've been a chef in New York City as well as in Maine. Is there a different culture, a different attitude towards foraging here?
Yeah, I think there is. And especially with foraged ingredients, in New York, there, you know, whatever foraged ingredients you have are probably sold to you through someone who specializes in that stuff or a distributor. And they're going to be really expensive, and they're, I think, put on a pedestal because they are special ingredients, and you're probably paying a lot of money for them, and you don't have a ton of them, so you have to use them sparingly. And the same can be true here in Maine, but they can also be a little more plentiful, and it's, you know, I think it's great to have a lot of pride in those ingredients because they're the things in our backyard and make Maine really special. And so, you know, you might be fortunate to go pick a basket full of chanterelles during the season, where in New York, if you were, you know, you'd be paying hundreds of dollars for that, or you'd have to spend a weekend driving out to the country to do it yourself. It's just not at your fingertips.
Sure. And I'm thinking, David, as I'm thinking about this topic and foraging and how, as Sam said, foraged produce is so precious. But we have to be real here, David, don't we? I mean, for millennia, people ate only what they foraged.
That's correct. I mean, across the swamp of time, human existence, I mean, we've been on the planet for 2 million years or so, and we've only been growing food and, you know, cooking has only developed over the past 10 or 15,000 years, which is, you know, like less than 1% of the time. So all the rest of the time, people foraged, and understanding the real definition of foraging is important because it means that you're gathering provisions. So foraging can mean you're looking for plants or you're looking for mushrooms, but you could also be looking for cordage or building materials or firewood or anything else you might need to promote continued human existence. Sure, you know, it's relatively new, and everyone still forages today. Everyone does.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Foraging has been sublimated and monetized, and now we call it shopping.
Oh, so that's
shopping,
great.
Shopping and getting food by shopping, it lights up all the same. The lights in your brain that foraging does, foraging in consideration of how long people have been foraging, you need to be clear on the idea that foraging is really built into human DNA. It's there.
Well, let me ask you this, David. So much land is private. How do you go about finding a place to forage, knowing getting permission? If someone's listening to this program and thinking, I've always wanted to, but it just all seems kind of so intimidating. When learning what I need to learn, what plants are edible, how to cook them, but then also finding a place to do the foraging, give us your basic lesson.
Well, I will say that there are plenty of places where it's completely fine to go and forage, you know, walking trails and different places where you forage, and whether you forage something or not really doesn't make any difference. And you know, millions and millions of pounds of forageable food go by the wayside every year without anyone picking them. However, if you are in a situation where it looks like you should ask, you should ask.
Okay, good guidance. Sam, I'm also thinking about cooking with foraged foods. I think most people know that fiddleheads, for example, need to be boiled first. You can't just throw them with a little butter. Many people can't just throw them in with a little butter because there is some toxicity. What other foraged foods are like that? What foraged foods does one need to have some knowledge so that one doesn't get sick?
Well, most mushrooms, for example, most foraged mushrooms need to be cooked. I mean, with a few rare exceptions, I'll eat raw porcinis, but pretty much everything else needs to be cooked or dehydrated. David probably is better suited to this than me, just because I'm looking at a smaller window of ingredients, but the milkweed pods, for example, I believe need to be cooked before they're eaten. Am I right about that?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. In fact, personally, I love milkweed, and I've been eating it right along. And you must boil milkweed. It must be boiled. It has cardiac glycosides, which need to be neutralized, and heating does that. But I've eaten milkweed since the late 1960s. I have it growing in my front yard, and I've been picking the flowers off and cooking them. And I just mowed them all off recently, and everybody throws up their hands and will say, monarch butterflies, monarch butterflies. But here's the thing. All that milkweed in my front yard is going to grow back before the monarch butterflies get here. And monarch butterflies actually prefer younger, more tender leaves. So when my milkweed grows back, I'll be the one that they're looking for.
All right. Before we go to a break, Sam, give us a quick recipe with something relatively easy to forage and easy to cook.
Well, right now, again, with beach roses, pretty plentiful. If you literally just take a bunch of beach roses and steep them in syrup and you get a beach rose syrup, you can freeze that into sorbet or granita with a little bit of lime juice. You can use it in a cocktail, some of that rose syrup and rum and or gin and some seltzer, and you have a beach rose fizz. So that's really a great thing to make right now.
Wonderful. When you say the beach rose, do you mean the flower only?
Yeah, exactly. The petals of the Rosa rugosa.
Okay. Well, that's a good tip to go to a break on. We are talking about foraging. What are your questions for our experts? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment on our Facebook page, or send us a quick email to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Encore Renewable Energy, committed to fueling Maine's economic recovery with solar energy for businesses and institutions. Encore.eco. And Breakwater, offering summer day camp programs for ages 3 to 18 through August 21st. Enrichment.breakwaterlearning.org.
Welcome to Maine Public's This Is My Maine.
I love living in Maine because it's the sort of place that requires a deep engagement and commitment from the people who live here. From raking your leaves in the fall to shoveling the snow in the wintertime to getting outside for summertime adventures. We're living on the frontier, and that means that we have to be deeply engaged with our environment and our community, and we're richly rewarded for that engagement. We have to work hard for the things that we want, and that's why I love Maine. I'm Phuc Tran. I'm not from Maine, but I moved here as fast as I could, and this is my Maine.
This Is My Maine is brought to you through the support of Eaton Peabody, the Maine Community Foundation, and the generous support of members like you. Thank you. Go to mainepublic.org to experience more of Maine Public's celebration of Maine's first 200 years. Happy birthday, Maine.
At 3 o'clock this afternoon, Maine Public Radio will rebroadcast last night's Republican 2nd District House primary debate, featuring Adrian Bennett, Eric Brakey, and Dale Crafts. Again, at a special time at 3 o'clock this afternoon, a rebroadcast of last night's 2nd District Republican primary debate. And a reminder, this debate and also our Your Vote 2020 Democratic Senate primary debate are available anytime at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are talking about foraging for wild foods. Joining me, Sam Richman, a chef and forager who owns Sammy's Deluxe in Rockland, and David Spar, a writer and expert in foraging and mushrooms. We invite you to be part of the conversation. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Lots of calls and emails coming in. But before we go to them, David, I want you to match Sam and give us a quick recipe.
Okay. Just something really simple. I like to take a piece of Maine fish, something like haddock, flounder, pollock, something like that, and cook it very, very plainly, and cook chanterelle mushrooms sautéed on the side in oil, or maybe oil and butter, and combine them at the end for fish with chanterelles on top. Because chanterelles are a white wine mushroom, and they belong with chicken or fish or vegetables or other foods you would normally eat with white wine.
Well, sounds delicious. Thank you for that. We're going to go to Robin, who's calling from Pembroke. Hi, Robin. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks. What a great show. I just wanted to point out there's often a lot of interest these days in foraging seaweeds on the shore, and newcomers and visitors and even some longtime residents may not realize that in Maine, where the seaweed grows, is also private property, and so are the seaweeds there. So it's always good to ask permission first.
All right, Robin, thanks. And while I've got you on the phone, do you forage seaweed? Do you have seaweed that you like to cook with, eat?
Actually, no. I like photographing them.
Okay, well, we'll turn to our other guest for that. Thank you so much for calling. And I'll turn to you for that, Sam. Do you use seaweed in your cooking?
Yeah, I love it. I don't really – I buy most of the seaweed from foragers. It's not totally in my wheelhouse collecting them, but I use a pretty wide variety of them, dulse and nori, different kelps for broths or for salads. And then also, in addition to seaweeds, what I do get are some vegetables, succulents that grow, like, and herbs that grow on the beach. Beach rocket or beach mustard is sort of looks like mini arugula, which has a really pungent, almost horseradishy flavor and is really crisp and juicy and a little bit salty. There's a kind of lamb's quarter that's like a hearty cooking spinach green that's really good and pretty plentiful on most Maine beaches. And then a few, there's sea beans and sea blight, other succulents that are almost like string beans that grow next to the ocean.
Well, David, what about you?
Well, I'm glad he mentioned those seaside forageables. And I want to point out that legally speaking, there's still a point of contention about who really owns what along the shore, because for the past 400 years or so, it has been that people only own as far as the high tide line. Now people want to change that, and we're going back and forth with it in court, whether people really think they own out in the ocean just because their deed says so. But it's not settled. But I have been eating sea blight and goose tongue and so-called sea beans or samphire this week. Some of the best vegetables you can find, as Sam mentioned, you know, grow along the high tide line. The orach, you mentioned the orach, which is the lamb's quarters type of a thing, and mustards and sea rocket. And I actually grow sea rocket at my house. And And yeah, and they're overlooked vegetables. Most people don't know them. And when I post items on some of the internet food and foraging groups, nobody seems to be familiar with these oceanside vegetables, which are really great.
So how do we learn about these? Do you teach classes on them? Does the cooperative extension, or does one join the Facebook group and just study the photographs carefully?
Well, you know, being on Facebook and being in these groups, you can find a considerable amount of really good expertise and a considerable amount of people that can really waste your time to be able to understand who's who. Maine mushrooms, for instance, and Maine foraging are both very good groups. And when it comes to cooking and recipes, I want to point out that on my Facebook profile, I have a food album, which has close to 800 entries in it of cooking with wild food. And that album is public. Anybody who's on Facebook can look at it and see all the different things that I do.
Terrific. We'll link to that both on our Facebook page and our webpage. Thanks so much for letting us know about that. I have an email here from Tori. Do you have a good recipe for honey syrup with spruce tips? And then John asks, are spruce tips good to harvest as long as they're still a lighter green than the rest of the branch? I'll start with you, Sam. Do you use spruce tips in your cooking?
I use them sparingly. I like them okay. I know some people really, really like them. I use them in cocktails or syrups, and maybe as a seasoning for grilled meats. They sort of have a, you know, as you would expect, a piney, hoppy aroma, sometimes reminiscent of like almost an IPA. I know I've gone on long hikes through the woods and really thinking about like finishing the hike and having a delicious beer afterwards and nibbling on a spruce tip that sort of made me think that I was having that beer. But mm-hmm. Sometimes I find they're aggressive, so I don't really cook with them too much with reckless abandon.
Sure. What about you, David?
Well, actually, I did a foraging adventure up in Mattawamkeag a couple of weeks ago, and we made a spruce tip sorbet. It's something that I make, and I really like it. And it's very basic, simple. You might call it a granada as well, or depends on how you make it. But basically, you take spruce tips and lime juice and honey and ice and in the blender and make it real, real, real smooth. It's really wonderful. It's really wonderful. Everybody at the event I was at loved it. So, and I actually make those kind of sorbets with balsam fir tips as well. And I was actually planning on making a sorbet tonight with pineapple weed. And pineapple weed, some people call it chamomile or false chamomile. And that's on the agenda for tonight. I've got some pineapple weed in my refrigerator.
I bet the inside of your refrigerator is quite interesting.
My pantry is unbelievable. It kind of scares me, the amount of dried mushrooms that I have. I got to eat mushrooms, you know. For a while in the winter, I was doing some cooking on, you know, showing people online what I was cooking on and saying, oh, I got to get rid of these hen of the woods. So this is what I did this time and then the next time, and I'm working on, because I had, you know, 2 or 3 gallons of dried hen of the woods mushrooms, and I didn't get through them. And, you know, I probably won't until next season rolls around. And, you know, it'll be the same kind of story again this year, because I usually find it pretty easy to round up, you know, 300 pounds or so of hen of the woods. So
great. I'm going to go to Greg Marley, who's calling in from Rockland. Hi, Greg. Go ahead. Greg, are you there? Hello? Well, shoot. I guess we...
I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm here. Yeah, I had you on mute accidentally. Yeah, thank you for doing this program. I want to just bring in the idea, you know, as David said, we've seen this huge rise in the number of people interested in foraging and eating wild mushrooms. And I have been a consultant with the poison centers in northern New England for about 15 years. And along with that rise in interest has been a rise in poisonings with symptoms, some very serious. So I really, really urge folks to be very clear of the identification before they eat them. And one of the more common groups that I've had some symptomatic poisonings over the past 5 years are some boletes. And too many people assume they're edible. So I just urge caution as you enjoy what you forage. And, you know, I know the Poison Center gets also a number of plants, calls around green plants for sickenings. So just be sure of what you're doing. Make sure you've got the resources.
Thank you, Greg, for that important warning. We have an email here from Kelly. Yellow wood sorrel is so common in lawns and gardens and can be used to make a lovely lemony sauce. Great on salmon. We chop and sauteed big batches of leaves all summer and freeze in ice cubes for use throughout the winter. To make a creamy sauce, you just heat with some heavy cream and stock. Chances are people are pulling this weed from their gardens all summer, so they might as well make the most of it. Also, staghorn sumac berries, the red cones, can be used to make a kind of lemonade-flavored drink and are actually the origin of our local custom of pink lemonade. Kelly, thanks so much for that information. Some nice food history. And I also love the idea of turning things that we think of as weeds into a sauce for salmon. I'm thinking, Sam, that everything, just about everything is good heated up with some heavy cream and stock, though, isn't it?
Yeah, that does sound great. And there's a classic dish of salmon and sorrel sauce. I feel like the wild sorrel, sort of little clover shape, is so pretty and delicate. I tend to use it more as an herb and in salads, but if you were to gather a ton of it, which would take a little time, definitely would be a great cooking cream too. Just a little labor intensive.
I'm going to go to Margaret, who's calling from Orland. Hi, Margaret. Oh yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, Margaret, you hold on and go ahead, David.
I wanted to comment on wood sorrel. I eat wood sorrel often, but I eat it in small quantities. Now the thing about, I learned about wood sorrel from other kids that I knew in the 1950s. We used to call it sourpuss. In any case, the one thing that's important to know about wood sorrel is that it does contain oxalates, oxalic acid, and that can have issues with people who have gout, gouty arthritis, or kidney issues, where it's important to be careful about how much you consume.
Okay. Are there others? So wood sorrel is something important for people who have gout. What about other other sort of commonly eaten foraged plants?
Sheep sorrel is the same. It has the same issues. The various docks, curly dock, lemon dock, that kind of thing. Same thing.
All right. Good advice. Thank you very much. Margaret, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I've been foraging for many years. Hold on. I'm 87, and I've been doing this I didn't even know what it was called. I was just always fascinated with wild plants, and I don't know, I'm intrigued with the idea of living simply so that you don't have to buy anything. I'm not much of a tightwad. Anyway, one thing I'm just playing around with and having a lot of fun with right now is daylilies. Now, they're sort of semi-wild. I mean, I think they've escaped from gardens. They're all over the wild places. And I have some in the front yard. And I'm playing around with picking the flower the day after.
Sure, that's okay. And you're kind of scratchy, so I'm going to turn this to David. Tell us about daylilies. What? How do you use them? How do you eat them? I think lots of us have lots of daylilies in our garden.
And I do, and they're coming out now. And to be honest with you, I've got a daylily recipe on tap for this evening. And when they start coming and looking good like this, I'm going to make some spring rolls. tonight with Daylily and, you know, summer rolls, Thai style spring or summer rolls.
Yeah, Daylily. What about you, Sam? Do you use Daylilies?
So I find Daylilies to be extremely delicious, especially the flower bulbs almost have a garlicky truffle-like flavor and aroma. But on the same theme of, you know, caution and edibility, while every single book I've read about daylilies says that they're edible, and I think they were brought here as a culinary ingredient, I've found that they don't agree with everybody. So I'll cook with them sometimes at home, but I won't use them in the restaurant just because I'm afraid of an adverse effect. But they really are tasty, and they're super pretty.
All right, and when you say the bulbs, you mean the roots that sort of spread
the flower, but like before the flower opens. So the
I see.
Bud.
Oh, the bud, not the bulb. Okay, the bud. Yeah. Okay, great. I'm glad I followed up with that, Margaret. Thank you for bringing that part up. And we are going to take another break. We are talking about foraging, in your own yard and in the woods. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling. With help from TrueLine, a full-service marketing and branding agency who believes in the value of local, independent journalism. Online at wearetrueline.com. Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners manage basement moisture problems with encapsulation and sump pump installation. And New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
A record high of 105 degrees Fahrenheit was recorded in North Bridgeton on July 10, 1911. The sweltering heat was indicative of an extraordinarily warm July of that year along the entire east coast of the United States. Temperatures climbed into the 90s and stayed there for multiple days. In an age before air conditioning or widespread use of electric fans, many struggled to cope with this multi-day deadly heat and succumbed to it. Death tolls on the East Coast are estimated to have topped 2,000 in just a few weeks.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Roosevelt Campobello International Park and the Island Institute. Happy birthday, Maine!
When the pandemic hit, New England states put moratoriums on evictions. That helped tenants who couldn't pay rent, but left some small landlords in a tough spot.
It's like everything I'm trying to do, it's working against me because they know the law. I can't evict them.
On Next, from the New England News Collaborative, with evictions expected to soar, the debate over extending the moratorium. Please join us.
And that's coming up today at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Our topic is foraging. My guest, David Sparr, who is a writer and foraging expert, and Sam Richman, a chef and forager. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Molly writes in an email, Vessel and Vine is a unique wine shop, cocktail bar, and restaurant in Brunswick. Owner Nicoline Iacono is an expert forager, and her menu is created using ingredients she forages herself. During the pandemic, Vessel and Vine has pivoted to be a retail shop and includes pre-bottled specialty cocktails using plants Nicoline is foraging right now. She also offers regular foraging classes for anyone interested in learning more. Really fun. And then an email from Lucy. I want a better list of things I can forage in my yard right now. Sorrel for one, but what else? So, David, what else?
Well, in my yard, I might have things in my yard other people don't have, but I do forage for sorrel, and I have Sedum purpureum around, and I have Monarda fistulosa, which is bee balm, which is actually Monarda fistulosa is native to Maine. And I've got mint, and I've got dandelion greens, and I've got mushrooms. I have a lot of wood chips in my yard, so I get wine cap mushrooms. And
I'm interested in what you say about bee balm. What do you do with bee balm?
Mostly with bee balm. Well, I use the leaves. In fact, when I make my spring and summer rolls tonight, they are going to contain large leaf. Each one will have one large leaf of dandelion, and then it will have a lengthwise sprig of sedum purpureum. If you saw it, Jennifer, you'd say, oh, that, I know what that is. It's a so-called stone crop. You can buy similar succulents in the at the greenhouse that don't taste as good. let's see, I'll have Monarda will be in that. Mint will be in that. Daylily is going to be in that. And also I have wild garlic bulbils. I collect and grow now.
All right, I'll be right over. I'm going to go to Aaron calling from Montville.
You're invited.
Aaron, go ahead.
Hi. I'm very grateful for this topic, but I have, I guess, more of a darker question. And I know that we as humans can have tendencies to be gluttonous or just overall disrespectful towards nature. And I'm just wondering if you guys have any level of concern over, I know you said that your Facebook groups are growing exponentially every day. And if you think that there's that potential that people might overdo it or, you know, just kind of ruin the fun and the sanctity of what foraging is for others.
Can I answer that, please?
Yes.
As true as it is that maybe in spot locations, it's possible that foragers could decimate a population or something. I don't think it's really that much of a worry if you say compare it to development. Now, what a logger, for instance, destroys more habitat in one day than all of the foragers combined in the state of Maine all year long. And there are a lot of loggers and there are a lot of days. And the real danger of losing things comes from that kind of activity and development. You know, you can't get rid of milkweed, for instance, unless you put a house there. So it's true as it is that foragers should be respectful of the areas that they go to, and to some extent maybe even manage them. That's what should happen. Because in the end, if you're a successful forager, you don't want to be just like hitting a spot and wiping it out and going to another spot and wiping it out. You want to go to a spot and get something, and then next year be able to come back to the same place and do the same thing.
Aaron, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Sulasa calling from Gorham. Hi, Sulasa. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? Good afternoon. Yeah, I have ingredient for dandelion leaf.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and so we cut it, the leaves, the small pieces, and we washed it. And we cut the onion for small pieces and grind the garlic. And we put the lime or lemon and black pepper with powder. And some people, they prefer to put the jalapeno, ground jalapeno. And we put also peanut butter. And we mix it together, and it's very delicious. And it's good for diabetics.
Sulasa, this cut up dandelion greens with
leaves, yeah.
Excuse me, yeah, with garlic and onion and lime. Do you serve it over rice or do you serve it on fish?
No,
how do you?
Actually, in Sudan, we eat it just like that, and some people they eat it with the bread, but it's good for if you eat it just like that with a spoon.
All right. Yeah. Well, Sam, what do you think of Sulasa's recipe from Sudan? Sam, are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think it sounds fantastic, and I would love to try it and eat some. I can't get enough of dandelion greens. I like them more and more every year, and they're really hearty. So cooking them with the recipe she just mentioned with a lot of seasonings, I think the dandelion can stand up to that, and it sounds really, really good, and I would love to try it.
Sulasa, thank you so much for calling in today. We're going to go to Michael going to from Lewiston. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks. I wanted to ask you about stinging nettles. Two things. I've heard not to eat them once they start flowering, and if you could speak to that. And then about the general edibility of the roots.
David?
I personally don't eat the roots. And as far as after flowering goes, that's a pretty good rule, I would say, except that I've always found that when, rules always have exceptions. And so it's usually a good idea to test the rule, like sample the plant or something like that. But in general, that is correct, that they will start to develop some bitter and off flavors once they start to flower. And the same thing goes for garlic mustard, too, by the way.
Okay, Michael, thank you for your call. We're going to go to Gail calling from Caribou. I think our first call from the county today. Hi, Gail.
Oh, hi, Jennifer. I've got on the stove right now a syrup. Everybody's already talked about what I'm cooking, so I won't tarry there. But I did go out this morning and get some pineapple weed and put it into my spruce tip syrup. And the combination, the citrusiness of the pineapple weed made it really a nice syrup. What I wanted to talk about, though, was there's a really good book that has helped me as a forager because, people, they hear these names, but really you do need to see pictures so you can help identify and then learn more about each one. The name of the book is Northeast Foraging, and the author is Lita Meredith. And it's just a great book for our area, even way up here. And the pictures are good. She doesn't talk about absolutely everything, but it's a good 300-page field guide. So I just wanted to put that out there. And maybe David and Sam know of this guide as well.
Well, Gail, I really appreciate it because we have a question from Judith asking, or excuse me, from Chris asking for a book to recommend. So thank you for just having a sense that somebody was asking that. Go ahead, David.
As far as recommending books go, I do recommend books by Sam Thayer. And Lita Meredith's book is good, too. I commiserate with her often online. We tend to show up in the same places at the same times. And I like her a lot.
Thank you, Gail, for your question. I have a question here for Judith. Can you talk about the importance of groundnuts and acorn as historic foods? Do you have any recipes using these? I'll turn to you, Sam.
I have never processed acorns, and it's a shortcoming in my culinary repertoire. I would love to do it. I'm really fascinated. I haven't gotten around to it.
All right. And what about you, David?
I've got some acorns sitting around in my kitchen that are supposed to be being processed, and I've eaten them a little bit here and there, and I kind of like them, but they are a lot of work to peel, and they need to be leached. Groundnut, we talked about groundnut, and groundnut, most people are familiar with eating the underground tubers, and I like them. They're similar to a Jerusalem artichoke or something like that, but some people particularly people who might have nut allergies or something like that might want to be careful with groundnut. And I grow it, and so and I eat the flowers. I like and eat the flowers of groundnut. Most people don't do that, I don't think, but it's an exceptionally fragrant and beautiful flower that I use for garnishes on some of my plates pretty often once they appear.
That's going to be our last word. We're out of time. Thank you guys so much for taking time with us on this Friday afternoon in July. Those guests, Sam Richmond, the chef and owner of Sammy's Deluxe in Rockland, and David Spar, a writer and forager. His book is called Edible and Medicinal Mushrooms of New England and Eastern Canada. Lucy Suchak ran the board today. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandreau. Today's program will be rebroadcast tonight at 7. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. We will have links to many of the things mentioned during today's program. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.